You may proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, other members of the court. I'm John Kiefer. It's pronounced Kiefer rather than Kiefer. I'm from Bristol, and I represent Mr. William Evans, who's in the courtroom with us today. Mr. Evans is a trustee of his mother's living trust, decedent's trust, called the Wanda S. Evans Trust. He is opposed by his brothers, who claim through his father, Mr. Douglas Evans. Mr. Douglas Evans made a deed of his tenancy by the entirety of his property to his wife, Wanda, in 1976, and broadly framed, the case presents two questions. Should Mr. Douglas Evans be afforded the personal freedom to make that conveyance? Is there any reason why he should not be given that privilege or right? Second question is, why are we here today? And this case was litigated and settled in Tazewell County in 1995. The facts are simple. The Evans husband and wife took tenancy by the entirety's property in 1973. In 1976, Mr. Evans made a deed to his wife of his property. In 1993, Mrs. Evans conveyed that to her then inter vivos trust, Mr. Dillard Shrewsbury is a name that appears in this record. He was the first trustee of that trust. Bill Evans has subsequently become the trustee.
Counsel, let me ask you, what, if any, is the significance of the fact that this deed was not recorded at the time of Ms. Evans' death?
I don't think there's any significance to it. It was made in 1993. It was acknowledged, court note, same day it was made, and it was delivered. I mean, it was in her possession. And
how do we know that?
Well, because her trust agreement, if you recall, specified what was to happen with that property following her death. She went ahead and made a dispositive division that gave her husband, Douglas, a life estate in that property, and then provided also that the trustee had the discretion to substitute out other residence properties for Mr. Douglas Evans. So she was fully aware and acted upon the ownership of that property that had been conveyed to her. She died in 1994. Within a year, Wayne Evans, one of the brothers, filed a suit in Tazewell County that raised this issue. It's here today as to whether there can be a conveyance by one spouse of tenancy by the entirety's property without the other spouse signing the deed. The statute and the cases that we've all seen talk about the husband and wife joining in a deed. They don't say anything about signing the deed, but leave that aside for a moment.
But are any of those cases the husband or the wife signing over their indivisible 50% interest to the other?
No, none of the cases that the court has ever decided, with the exception of that Jones case, Jones versus Obenshain, in 1853, dealt with a direct conveyance from a spouse to a spouse. Every one of the tenancy by the entirety's cases that's been cited and we've all read has dealt with a third-party creditor situation where it was necessary in order to protect the homestead, in effect, of the family pair, the husband and wife, to insulate the claims against the jointly held property from a single credit, but that was the
but none of that logic applies between a husband's conveying his undivided interest to the wife or the wife conveying her undivided interest to the husband.
I'm sorry, what was the question?
None of those policy concerns in those cases implicate your case.
No. The basic policy of real estate conveyancing the Commonwealth has been the intent of the party should govern, and the party should be given as much freedom to transact their lives as is possible without implicating or damaging third parties or hurting anybody. And Mrs. Evans benefited. She got a complete fee simple title that she could devise, bequeath, convey. It was the transaction was entirely in her favor. And, you know, fair question. Why shouldn't a husband who has love and affection and expresses that as the consideration in the deed be able to make that make that conveyance? Trial court held, I think, if you read his opinion, that a signature was necessary in order for the wife to be held to have joined in the deed. And in the brief, I pointed out, in addition to the policy reasons, the Langhorne versus Board of Visitors case, University of Virginia case, real important case that described the status of a grantee in a deed. And the grantee in the deed is not a passive party. The grantee in the deed is an active party, as that case made very clear. Is held responsible for the obligations incurred in the deed, fully receives the benefits conferred by the deed. Trial court ignored that, didn't give that any heed. So he went ahead and held it, notwithstanding that she had conveyed it to her living trust and the other indicia that she had actively considered and managed that property. Went ahead and denied the party's right to have their intention.
Isn't the signature requirement something that presupposes the necessity for both parties to be grantors? And if that necessity is inapplicable, where they're granting to each other, then the signature requirement fails as well. It's not relevant anymore.
I think so. I think that's the case. That the wife doesn't have to sign. She's participating. She is joining. And that's the word that's in the Vassalon case and these other cases. They talk about joining. They don't talk about signing.
But she's not granting anything. She's receiving
everything. She's receiving. And that is her participation, if you will, her intimate participation in that transaction. The second thing the judge did, and the court just talked about the after-acquired property statute, as one of you referred to it, 55-52, a troublesome statute, as you can see. The court held, and there was another related doctrine, actually probably a primary doctrine in this case, which is the doctrine of estoppel by deed, that has been described as being enacted as 55-52, but I think it's pretty clear that they're independent sources of legal right. The Vepco versus Buckwalter case was decided well after 55-52 was enacted, and it held that a grantor and his successors, such as the Evans defendants, were bound by the conveyances of their predecessor. And the trial court held that the only time that this after-acquired property or estoppel by deed applies is when the grantor owns nothing, didn't own the property before the time of his purported conveyance. And then when he thereafter obtains it, it flows through the operation of the statute. But the case law is very clear that it doesn't make any difference whether you own the property or don't own the property when you make that conveyance. If you do, yourself and your successors are bound by that. And the Wilkinson case and a couple others that I cited in the brief are very clear about that. You don't have
counsel, does the deed have to be effective?
Pardon?
Does the first deed have to be effective in transferring the property?
Don't think so. Because in the school board case, for example, in that case, the school board hadn't complied with the statutory requisites to make a valid conveyance, you know, by a school board. Court held, doesn't matter, that was not, that they didn't have authority, that it could have been avoidable conveyance. They said the school board purported to do it, and the grantee is protected. Same thing in the the Green case that's cited in the papers. Wilkinson, fellow had a life estate, conveyed a fee. he didn't have, you know, it wasn't a valid conveyance as a matter of the law, you know, because he didn't have a fee. He only had a life estate. The court recognized those opinions as those circumstances as giving rise to an estoppel. And it's basically a question of fairness. You make a deed to somebody, you ought to be able to rely on it and have it given effect. Let me briefly address this lawsuit because we're talking about fairness. Shortly after Wanda died, Brother Wayne filed a suit on behalf of his children who were named in the testamentary documents. And he alleged that the conveyance to Wanda, this is this second deed in the chain that you've been thinking about, was not valid because of the supposed rule on the tenancy by the entireties question. That suit was filed in Tazewell in 1995, right on the eve of the death of Wanda. It was dismissed on procedural grounds, but the settlement that the parties reached specifically recognized this issue and specifically provided that Douglas was to receive $81,000, which he got in exchange for his rights that were involved in this litigation, which was this tenancy by the entireties issue. The case was actually supposed to have been dismissed with prejudice that would have given us a res judicata defense, but it wasn't for whatever reason, inadvertence, inattention, don't know, nothing in the record on that. But it was the very same issue. Douglas died in 2012. He continued to live in the property as a life tenant because that's what he had been given under the Wanda Trust that was accepted as part of this settlement. He lived in the property until 2012. He died. Shortly thereafter, this litigation ensued, raising this very issue again. I mean, nobody ever went to him in the ensuing 17 years and said, "Dad, what do you think? Do you have a life estate or not?" I mean, nobody had a chance to ask him, go to the horse's mouth, and get some evidence on this. This litigation was sprung on us, and you know, we're here today asking that the settlement agreement be recognized as a contractual obligation of parties that would preclude this litigation.
What was the reason the trial court did not give effect to the settlement agreement?
Darn if I know. He said that it was part of his decision by implication. And I think the quote from the hearing transcript is in the record. He never gave it a great deal of attention.
Was there ever any dispute in this litigation that the settlement agreement clarified that Douglas only owned the life estate? Was there ever any dispute over that as to what the settlement agreement was?
No, I don't think so. I mean, it was fully litigated and argued back and forth about, you know, what it meant and how it came about and all that sort of thing. I don't know. The court said it was relevant that he needed to look at it, but he never told us really what his thinking was, other than it was by implication, I think, were his words. Judge, let me reserve, if I might, a moment or two of my time.
Yes.
Thank you.
Mr. Chief Justice, Justice of the Court, may it please the Court, my name is Mark Black, and I represent the appellees that have been referred to in the briefs as the Evans defendants.
Mr. Black, let me ask you, what policy or whatever would justify requiring, as in this case, one of the spouses to sign a deed conveying to her the entire fee? I mean, why is it creditors aren't affected? Why do we have such a rule if we have it?
Well, I think we do have it since Vazelon, and it's been cited by this court requiring a joint conveyance. The policy aspect is, I mean, all throughout, you know, tenants by entireties is one of the most important doctrines in Virginia, and we're joined, comes up all the time. And I think it's certain, to answer the question, I think it's certainty to, rather than having to look around, you know, what did the grantor do? What did the grantee do? Was it joint? Were they together on it? As opposed to if husband and wife convey the property to wife, there's clarity. There's no doubt about it that the tenancy by entirety has been dissolved, and that's the policy reason.
What doubt do you have if a husband grants 100% of his undivided interest to his wife? How does a lawyer read that and say, well, I think tenancy by entirety still exists? I mean, I don't get the logic of that at all.
I'm sorry, logic
of saying that if we were not to agree with you, the law would be unclear. If you have a tenancy in entirety and a husband says to a wife or a wife to a husband, I grant you 100% of my interest, in my undivided interest in this tenancy. How could, and now the 100% of the interest is not in a tenancy by entirety anymore. It's in full fee ownership of the grantee party. That seems very clear. I don't know why the law would be confused about that.
Well, the law has been clear, and this court has been clear that it's not signatures that are required. It's both parties being a grantor.
But has any Virginia case said that between the husband and the wife, between themselves? Of course, both of them have to sign a grantor deed if they're dealing with a third party. But I may be mistaken, but I didn't read your cases or any other cases in Virginia to say that a husband and a wife can't among themselves effectually dissolve the tenancy by entirety by one giving up 100% of the undivided interest to the other.
Well, what this court has said, for example, in Wasky, the court gave an example how the husband there could have acquired 100% title, dissolved the tenancy, and the court gave the example of the husband and wife joining together and conveying it to the husband. And the other answer to that, Your Honors, is that if we're getting into policy, we have in Virginia Section 55-9, and that was cited in Vazelon, it was cited in Wasky, as a statute that says that it's okay if the grantors and the grantees are in common, meaning that a husband and wife can convey tenancy by entirety property to a wife or to a husband, and that is okay. And that is the statutory determination. Some states, for example, I was with a brother-in-law who's an attorney in North Carolina, and pulled up a case at a statute out of North Carolina, 39-13.3, entitled Conveyances Between Husband and Wife. That statute gives residents of North Carolina what the appellants are asking for here, but the legislature did that. The legislature made that policy.
Counsel, what is the last sentence?
Sir?
What is the meaning of the last sentence in that statute mean? What does it mean? Didn't it say deeds recorded prior to whatever? Isn't that in that statute?
In North Carolina?
No, I'm talking about Virginia. In the Virginia statute.
In the 55-9?
Yeah.
As all such conveyances made prior to July 1, 1986 are validated, notwithstanding defects in the form thereof, which do not affect vested rights.
And this deed was prior to that, wasn't it?
This deed was from 1976.
Okay. So what if any is the significance of that sentence in the statute?
I don't think that there's a significance. I think the significance of the statute is allowing the parties to do what the parties generally in Virginia have always done, is to join together as grantors. And the legislature can change the statute.
For that, it seems to me. Suppose, like in this case, the wife doesn't want it. And she doesn't want it because the status of tenants by the entireties gives her protection against third-party creditors. So if she wants to have that protection, so she doesn't join into the deed. Isn't that a good enough reason? That's a friendly question, by the way. I wouldn't spend a whole lot of time thinking about the answer.
Yes, Mr. Chief Justice, that is a good reason. It's as my earlier answer in terms of the certainty.
The husband can't force the wife to take the deed in that scenario.
If both are grantors.
No. I'm going back to what the Chief Justice asked you. If the husband says, well, I'm going to transfer my interest to my wife, and the wife is thinking, well, I don't want to do that because I might not be protected from my creditors, the husband cannot force her to accept the deed, can he?
That's correct, Your Honor. That's correct.
But you didn't answer that when you answered the Chief's question, did you?
Well, the husband can't force, but that's a good reason.
What would it take to get it to her? Delivery, right? The answer to that question is yes, too.
An acceptance, yes.
Right. So he does the deed and he delivers it to her. What did she do? I don't want it. Rip it up. What did she do?
She does whatever she chooses with it. It's not effective. It's not effective. This court has held that the requirement of a grantor of both spouse joining as a grantor.
But going back to this is a very important hypothetical, as you can tell. Is your understanding of Virginia real property law that physical delivery to a grantee, even if the grantee does not want to accept delivery and is disavowing delivery, but nonetheless, delivery occurs, what does the state of the law say as to whether or not there actually is an effectual conveyance in that kind of hypothetical?
There's a conveyance in the situations outside of what we're talking about outside the facts of this case, where we're dealing with tenants by the entireties that require a joint conveyance. And to have a joint conveyance, both have to be grantors.
Let me change the hypothetical. Suppose I wanted to grant to you a piece of property that's 100% in my name. And you say, I don't want it. Don't grant it to me. And I say, I'm going to anyway for some nefarious reason, I suppose. And I do the grantor deed. I do it all right. I put it in your hands, and you tell me, I don't want this. I'm not asking for this, and I'm not accepting it. Would it be the law that I could say, but it's yours now. I'm out of here.
I think that she has to accept delivery. She has to accept it.
Okay.
Well, I mean, she tears it up, and it's of no validity in the general sense.
Well, if that's true, and assume for the sake of our continuing conversation it is true, are there other possibilities where the rule that one spouse can grant to the other without both spouses granting to the other could produce prejudice somewhere down the line in some unforeseen situation that we're not hypothesizing?
I think that the prejudice is that the wife may lose a protection. Tenants by entireties is
that's a great point. How would she do that? I'm not following. I don't understand. How would she lose some protection? What would she lose?
As I think the Chief Justice said earlier, in terms of the protection that tenants by entireties afford both of the married
and she
married
could refuse
couple.
Delivery of the deed then, and she keeps her protection.
She could.
Counsel, why isn't the settlement agreement binding? Settlement agreement.
Well, the problem with the settlement agreement is that the settlement agreement was related to the trust, and it related to rights that Mr. Evans, Douglas Evans, had under the trust. And the problem is that he remained the owner of that property. From 1973, when he acquired it, 1976, we have a void conveyance. There was attempted transfer by Wanda Evans. All throughout that time, he remained the owner of that. And he did not take through the trust. That agreement had to do with his rights under the trust. And he did not take through the trust. He took as the remaining tenant by entirety. And he remained the owner of that property until such time as he were to convey it away.
But didn't he convey it away in the trust when he accepted their $81,000 in full settlement of any and all claims that may have arisen out of the transaction?
Madam Justice, he did not convey anything. There was no conveyance. That was one of the points in our brief, that to convey something, it needs to be a deed. If there had been a requirement that he sign a deed and he make it the grantee, the trustee of the trust, and that would be a different situation. There was no deed. There was no conveyance of that. And that's the only way in Virginia to transfer property, and that was not done in 1995.
But wasn't the argument that it had already been conveyed at that point in time? And this was just giving up this claim he might have had, that the conveyance was not proper? Isn't that what the settlement was about?
The settlement was about the trust and what was being given to Mr. Wayne Evans' daughters under the trust, what was given to Mr. Douglas Evans under the trust, and the property was a collateral part of that, but that was not the core of that case. It was not the core of the settlement agreement. I think and the trial court, while his opinion is not clear, is not as clear as it could be, the trial court determined that because he had owned that property always as a tenant by entirety, that settlement agreement had no effect, and I think in his words did not impact or change his decision with regard to both his interpretation of tenants by entireties and that doctrine in 55-52.
Wasn't the entire dispute that the settlement agreement attempted to resolve was whether the conveyance to the wife without her joining in was valid? And wasn't that the issue that they were attempting to settle by resolving this, giving him a life estate and the money that he received? I mean, it's a pretty broad subject to the provisions of paragraph 2 for themselves. Officers, directors, partners, agents hereby release, discharge claims, causes of action in law or equity they may have or that may arise in the future. So pretty broad release.
It's broad, but that was the marital property was not the core subject of that settlement agreement. In my closing seconds, Your Honors, the trial court got it right. The trial court was right in requiring a joint conveyance by the husband and wife in 1976. The trial court got it right in that Mr. Evans remained the owner of the property and did not acquire new interest, and the trial court got it right in implicitly, to use his language, implicitly finding that the settlement agreement did not have an impact on his decision.
Thank you, Mr. Black. Mr. Keeper. 57 seconds left.
Three very brief things. Number one, 55-59 uses the word may. It doesn't say the only way to have one of these inter partes deeds is by a joint conveyance. Uses the word may. So aside from the question of the effective date, I don't think it affects this case particularly. Second, interesting thing, your question, I believe, was, you know, what do you do if somebody tries to cram a deed down on you? If you look at the Langhorne case and the language I quote, court right there tells you what the remedy is. You can renounce the deed, you cannot accept the deed, you cannot act under the deed in pite and pace, whatever how that's pronounced. So you can't force it upon the party. And she's getting a bigger estate than she ever had.
She did what? She
got a larger estate, a fee simple estate, as opposed to an entirety's estate.
Well, that depends on whether she had creditors that were going to take it from her.
Yeah, but there were none.
She wouldn't want it. If that the entirety's actually keeps these third-party creditors from getting to that.
Right, but there's nothing of that in this record. No indication.
Oh, I know, but the question is an abstract question.
Okay.
You're right, there's nothing like that in this record, but if there's a reason for requiring that both of them sign, that might be one of the reasons.
Let me leave you with one thought. I've run into this problem 3 times in examining titles in the last year. Impossible to determine from the record oftentimes what the state of the marriage is at the time of the conveyance. There was a divorce, there was an estate, there was a foreclosure. This is a common conveyancing problem that you cannot determine by looking at the names of the parties in the record. You can't go to, if the divorce is not in that county, and I've run into that, you have no way of knowing.
All right. Thank you very much. Call
yes,
the next case.